Hello, everybody, and good afternoon. We're going to get started promptly here at the 46th minute after the hour. I'm Matt Lunning from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. So I will be the moderator today. I will be playing Neil Love, and I am joined today by two esteemed faculty, Dr. Josh Brody from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, New York, and Dr. Jason Weston from MD Anderson Cancer Center here in Houston, Texas. So this program is accredited for continuing medical education. You can see here that this was brought to us and supported by an educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb and Novartis. We will disclose our conflict of interests in the packet. You can see here that this is for a medical education as an accredited provider by Research to Practice. We may discuss some disclosure of unlabeled usage during this program. If we report or if you have reporting any adverse events, please report them per your institutional policy. And here is our today's topic. Here is the agenda. Dr. Weston will lead us off. I will then go in the sandwich middle, the meat, and then Dr. Brody, I guess you get to be the bottom part of the bun. Okay? All right. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Weston to kick us off.
Wonderful. Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us here in person as well as online. I'm Jason Weston from MD Anderson here in Houston, Texas. And today my charge is to talk about integration of CAR T-cell therapy into the management of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. These are my disclosures. And this audience knows well the concept of a CAR T-cell, but the ZUMA-7 clinical trials wouldn't introduce it into our earlier line of therapy and management algorithm. And we'll go through briefly the data that support why this is now something that should be integrated into our practice, not as a novel therapy that we've heard of but don't really know much about, but something that's part of our day-to-day practice in managing patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The ZUMA-7 clinical trial was a randomized phase 3 study randomizing 359 patients 1-to-1 to the standard of care of chemotherapy and if responding followed by autologous transplant versus axi-cel, the autologous CD19 product. And the clinical trial was looking at patients who were refractory to first-line therapy or had relapsed within 12 months of their initial treatment. The patients who responded to the chemotherapy went on to get transplant, or if they didn't respond, they could come off and subsequently get whatever treatment they want, which we'll talk about in the next slide. We updated the data last year showing that the event-free survival continues to be dramatically improved by the CAR T-cell therapy. This yellow curve clearly separates early and durably from the blue curve of chemotherapy. You'll note that the overall and complete response rates for CAR T-cell, 83% and 65%, compare very favorably to what we saw for standard of care. And this statistically significant improvement in event-free survival led to an expansion of the label for axi-cel to now include patients who are relapsed or refractory in second-line therapy. The update we showed last year is that it also improved overall survival in a statistically significant fashion. And this is quite interesting because over half of the patients on the control arm, the chemotherapy arm, actually received subsequent cellular immunotherapy as their third or later line of treatment. So effectively, there was an off-protocol crossover for more than half the patients on the standard of care. They got chemo first, followed by CAR T-cell, as opposed to those who got CAR T-cell as a second-line treatment, and still the overall survival was statistically significantly improved. So this, in my opinion, effectively ends the debate about should you save CAR T-cell only for patients that chemo doesn't work, or should CAR T-cell be your preferred approach for patients in second line? Clearly, overall survival is the endpoint we'd love to see improved in all of our clinical trials. And here, axi-cel had a statistically significant improvement in overall survival. But of course, that wasn't the only trial in second line showing CAR T-cell was superior to standard of care. The TRANSFORM clinical trial looked at lysocell, or lysocabtagene maraleucel, compared with standard of care. A couple of important differences about this trial. This trial did allow for one cycle of bridging chemotherapy for the CAR T-cell arm, whereas ZUMA-7 only allowed steroids. This trial also allowed for a crossover built into the clinical trial. If a patient on the control arm didn't achieve a response that was durable, they could receive CAR T-cell therapy on the clinical trial. And very similar in my mind to what we saw in ZUMA 7, an enormous improvement in event-free survival favoring liso-cel over standard of care. And those response rates overall of 87% and a complete response rate of 74% from the updated data from ASCO this year, very impressive compared to what we've seen historically in this refractory or early relapse population. The overall survival curves do separate and were durably separated. However, the statistical significance was not quite achieved in this TRANSFORM clinical trial, although the hazard ratio of 0.757 is quite close to what we saw in ZUMA 7, which was 0.73. So pretty darn close in my mind between these two, but ZUMA 7 did have the overall survival statistically significantly improved. What about in patients who are not eligible for transplant? Patients who are elderly, had organ dysfunction, were less fit. What about CAR T-cell therapy in a second-line population there? Well, the liso-cel program was evaluated in the pilot clinical trial, which showed outcomes that looked pretty darn similar to what we saw in the TRANSFORM clinical trial for patients who were not considered by their treating physician to be eligible for a stem cell transplant. The Alicante study showed very similar results for axi-cel as well. Both of these showed that CAR T-cell can be delivered in patients who historically had been considered borderline for stem cell transplant, expanding what I would consider to be a curative treatment option for those patients historically that may not have been able to benefit from that approach. So this leads to an updated algorithm that Dr. Sen and I published now 2 years ago, showing that in second line for large B-cell lymphoma, the question is no longer, is this patient eligible for transplant, yes or no? The question is now, how long ago was their first line therapy? And that vast majority of patients that suffers relapse within the first year, that answer should be, can the patient go for CAR T-cell? The next step is the patient eligible for CAR T-cell, yes or no? And in our algorithm, we thought it would not be 50-50 anymore, but more like 70-30 that patients could be eligible, having that transplant ineligible population now be eligible for CAR T-cell therapy. So this is now integrated into our practice in a way that historically was saved for third plus line. It now is the standard of care second line therapy at my center. Why is that? Well, we know that the CAR T-cell responses appear to be very durable. And I use the word cure when I say my patients had a durable response for more than a year after CAR T-cell therapy. That's based on long-term follow-up from the original pivotal studies, ZUMA 1, JULIET, and TRANSCEND, which in my eye show very similar curves. An initial drop, yes, but a plateau that appears quite durable now with many years of follow-up. So a 5-year follow-up for ZUMA 1, and multiple-year follow-up for both JULIET and TRANSCEND. So these are now approved products, axi-cel and liso-cel for second-line plus, and tisa-cel for third-line plus for patients with large B-cell lymphoma. And this is the updated overall survival curve at 5 years, which looks awesome. So in the remaining few moments, we'll talk about what's coming next for the ZUMA 12 clinical trial updates that were presented as an update at the ASCO meeting earlier this year. ZUMA 12, for your reminder, was a frontline clinical trial of patients with IPI 3-5 or double hit and having a PET scan that showed a residual partial response after 2 cycles of chemotherapy, a Duvall score of 4 or 5. The patients went on to receive axi-cel, and the response rate of 92% with 86% CR rate, and that durability of response, very impressive in this double high-risk group, high IPI, double hit, and inadequate response on PET scan, and look at this result. The PFS and OS also very impressive, and that has led to the ZUMA 23 clinical trial, which is randomizing patients with IPI 4 or 5 to either 6 cycles of standard chemotherapy or effectively 2 cycles of chemotherapy followed by axi-cel for IPI 4 and 5. This trial is up and running globally, and we're looking forward to seeing results in the coming years. In the last few moments, we'll touch briefly on novel products, including rapcabtagene autoleucel. This is a CD19-targeting autologous product that has a very rapid manufacturing time frame, with preliminary results looking very promising with high response rates. With firi-cel, this is a CD22-targeting CAR T-cell therapy, with the early results looking promising, especially in patients who had a prior CD19 CAR T-cell, finally being able to target different antigens, so this is quite impressive. And lastly, cema-cel, which is targeting a population of patients who are post-first-line therapy with a PET scan CR and with a positive ctDNA test. So as far as we can tell on conventional imaging, they're in remission. But based on a ctDNA test, they have a positive test. They're going on to the Alpha 3 clinical trial, randomizing patients to observation versus an allogeneic CD19 CAR T-cell, cema-cel. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well done, Dr. Weston. So you did a great job of staying on time. You set the gauntlet for both Dr. Brody and myself. Before we get to the case presentation from Dr. Brody, maybe I'll ask you a question. So you highlighted the ZUMA 23 trial design. You know, kudos to you and your colleagues who have planned this trial because you allowed actually a lead-in cycle, which we had all been asking for so long. However, that lead-in cycle can't be Pola-R-CHP, and it doesn't appear that Pola-R-CHP is in that trial. Do you think that that will change the study at all, or its ability to accrue quickly?
Yeah, thank you. So the ZUMA 23 clinical trial targeting that frontline high-risk group, patients are required to have one cycle of treatment before they're even eligible for the study. But just to clarify, they can have Pola-R-CHP as that initial treatment. It's R-chemo. Whatever you get, R-chemo as the first cycle. But when you come on trial, in the standard of care arm, Pola-R-CHP is not included. So you either would get dose-adjusted R-EPOC or R-CHOP. Because the 50303 trial read out showing that R-CHOP and R-EPOC were similar, in my practice, what I've been doing for high-risk patients, double-hit patients, patients that I think may not benefit from R-CHOP, we've been using dose-adjusted R-EPOC. So it is a limitation of the trial, but I don't think it will impact the results.
That is an excellent explanation. Thank you, Dr. Weston. And now I'm going to move over to Dr. Brody to go ahead and go through our first case.
Excellent. Dr. Lunning, thank you so much. Am I getting your name right? Is that Lunning? Am I pronouncing
it? It is Lunning. It's not Looning.
It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Lovely. So everyone, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're not here for the food. I know you're here for the nutrition of learning. I'm going to present very quickly a patient of mine. He's a pretty average patient, I think. 71-year-old guy, diabetes, high blood pressure, moderate COPD, oxygen independent, walks a few blocks without dyspnea. He was diagnosed with DLBCL, non-GC subtype. He got Pola-R-CHP, as this Dr. Looning was just referring to, and had a great response. So you can see there his mesenterium, some of his retroperitoneum, filled with FDG-avid lymphoma prior to therapy. Pretty easy to see. After his Pola-R-CHP, he had a complete remission. All that black you see there is just renal calyces in the collecting system and going into the bladder. So he had a complete remission, CMR. However, pretty quickly thereafter, relapse, and you can see there in the right cervical nodal chain, he had a, I think it was a 4x3 centimeter, but rapidly progressing, I mean, because he could feel it changing even week to week. Development, rebiopsy demonstrated relapse disease, not a great surprise, and so we treated him with radiotherapy as a debulking, not as a bridging therapy, and then he had a pretty good partial response to the radiotherapy, and then afterwards with anti-CD19 CAR T-cell as per the ZUMA-7 trial, as per the TRANSFORM trial in this case. He got lysocell, and we can talk about that decision, and he had a beautiful response. You actually can see a little inflammation in his esophagus, which was, we were told, for the consequence even of his radiotherapy, but otherwise another beautiful complete remission. This patient, I followed him for only about a year since then, but he's maintained his CR for a year, and as Dr. Weston was saying, therefore, we think has a pretty good prognosis. And I will pause after that description.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Brody, for that case. And maybe I'll turn to you, Dr. Weston. And, you know, we've heard a lot about age in relation as a variable for eligibility for CAR T-cell. In my practice, I don't use age as a variable to dichotomize, but we have multiple CAR T-cells now in this space. You know, this person was marching, you know, towards 72. Let's say this patient is 55 instead of 72. You know, how would you kind of walk through the two products that we have available for him?
Yeah, I think that age is certainly one of the variables we consider, but not everybody is the same physiology at different ages. We all have patients who are 72, who are 72 going on 52, and 72 going on 172. That is a real difference, in my opinion, in terms of sort of their eyeball test. Is this patient fit enough to tolerate a treatment that might have real deal side effects? In the ZUMA-7 trial, we did go back and look at those patients who were elderly, who were over the median age, and they actually appeared to do better than the younger patients with CAR T-cell therapy. The event-free survival was perhaps improved in elderly patients compared to younger patients. Not exactly sure why, but clearly CAR T-cell therapy can be delivered safely to patients in their 70s, 80s, and in rare cases, even up into their 90s. The toxicity part of it is a key consideration. And so if your patient is borderline fitness, looking at a CAR T-cell product that may have a lower incidence of neurologic toxicities or high-grade CRS, Lysocell does appear to have a lower risk of those side effects in the clinical trials. That may be a differentiating factor.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that now I'll turn to Dr. Brody. And this gentleman's going to hop in his DeLorean, and he's now going to be 83 years old. You know, Dr. Weston showed us not only the pilot data, but also the Alicante data, looking at, you know, those individuals with comorbidities or advanced age and receiving CAR T cell. If I reflect back on ZUMA-7, Dr. Weston, I think the oldest individual in ZUMA-7 was 82. You know, so you had to be transplant eligible, but also CAR T cell eligible to go into that. But now we have this data set. Now, how do you have a 83-year-old discussion, you know, going to CAR T-cell when we have, as Dr. Weston showed, numerous other agents besides CAR T-cell that this person may be available to receive?
Yeah, real tricky. Jason was hinting at maybe 83-year-olds going on 53, but even that guy will very quickly, with the toxic therapy, no longer be going on 53. He'll be going up to 183, as was said. So, this was, like you said, a 1 year older than even existed on the ZUMA-7 trial. You could be brave if he was an 83-year-old marathon runner. You know, rules are made to be broken, but for us, we don't have, as you said, we don't have a cutoff age, but we have, as Jason said, what's referred to as the lick thumb test. You lick your thumb, point it at the person, and that doesn't look like that person's getting axicell. And certainly if they had the comorbidities of the patient I described, for sure. So the question is, you know, what are some alternatives here? So again, now we have a couple of, I don't even want to talk about, because the question was pointing at bispecific antibodies, I don't want to talk about bispecific monotherapy, but combination, bispecific plus chemo, and we have randomized phase 3 data showing an overall survival benefit with STARGLO and pretty similar data with GemOx and epcoritamab in a phase 2 trial, and that included some second-line patients, especially those. And the median age in some of those studies was low 70s as opposed to, you know, 59 in the CAR-T trials.
I agree. I think it has been impressive to watch the bispecifics, you know, make its now march into the commercial setting through multiple phase 2 trials. Now we have randomized data. And if you look into those trials, you know, there were people in the 90s getting onto clinical trials. So I think that's impressive for that active class of therapy.
You got to march into the future. You can't take a DeLorean everywhere.
That's right. So now I'm going to move into my second case for both of you. So this is a gentleman who was 72 years old when he was first diagnosed. And he had leg type large cell lymphoma, got R-CHOP times 6. He relapsed 3 years later, now at the age of 75, with diffuse skin lesions. And I chose to treat him with tafasitamab lenalidomide as he didn't want to do CAR T-cell at the time. I did dose reduce his len down to 10 milligrams because he did have some mild renal insufficiency. He did quite well with tafalen and derived got through the lenalidomide portion and derived benefit up until about 18 months on tafa monotherapy. We then kind of had a discussion again, and we chose to march towards CAR T-cell. He was Pola unexposed, so I could still use Pola R as a bridge. And he got to Flu-Cy LDC, and he received Tisa-cel. Only had grade 1 CRS without any ICANS, and he was in a metabolic CR. But I think one of the issues that we often hear about with ye of little data is, you know, can we do CAR T-cell in patients who have just been exposed to a CD19 perturbing agent like tafasitamab? And, you know, how are you walking through, Dr. Weston, you know, these unique situations where you don't have a lot of data, but you think that curative therapy could still be approached?
Yeah, I think in general, CD19 should still be expressed and it still should be a good option to consider. So we know that there are multiple randomized frontline studies ongoing, and one that has completed enrollment but not yet read out is the study of R-CHOP plus tafasitamab lenalidomide. We'll see if that is positive or not, but if it were, I still think CAR T-cell would be an option for those patients. However, I biopsy all my patients to see if 19 is still expressed. So if a patient has already had a 19-facing therapy and I'm considering CAR T-cell, or they had CAR T cell and I'm considering a 19 facing therapy, I do think getting a biopsy is a valuable thing to do because there are other options. This patient could be considered for bispecific antibody therapy or other options such as loncastuximab. So CAR T cell is a great option, but I would get a biopsy to evaluate 19.
Gotcha. And Dr. Weston, I may make you put your nickel down, not a quarter, just a nickel,
okay,
on what you think is your preferred CAR T cell for large cell lymphoma.
That is going to cost more than a nickel to get my preferred CAR. No, I'm kidding. I think they're all great. I will take a politician's answer there and say I like axi-cel and lysocell and tisocell. I do think the reliability of manufacturing is a key consideration, and being able to deliver a product on time is very important, and I've been quite impressed with the manufacturing process from the axi-cel team.
I think that's a fun way to be a moderator, is I just get to ask you. Dr. Brody, are you going to take the politician's high road here? Or?
You know, I'm diplomatic. If nothing else, the answer is axi-cel. But for a 71-year-old with COPD and hypertension, clearly lysocell, because I put my money where my foot is, where my mouth is, whatever. I gave that guy lysocell.
I agree, and I call myself an ambassador of cellular therapy. I do not restrict myself to one construct either. I think that the goal should be is having the discussion first off, because you know we know that access remains the major issue to cellular therapy, and the fact that we still aren't seeing all of the patients who may be able to derive benefit from this therapy. And with that, that's my political statement.
Well done.
All right, so right on time, I'm going to jump on over to Module 2. Where I'm going to walk through, actually a blitz through. For the, many of you know, a thematically talk. I had to consult Taylor Swift for some plays because her and I were drawing up some for the Chiefs this week, but I had to remove them because of time limitations. So they're all blitz packages. So we're going to go through CAR T-cell therapies for relapse refractory, follicular lymphoma, mantle cell, and CLL. Here are my disclosures. And here are my objectives. So we're going to talk about the follicular lymphoma data, then move right into the mantle cell data, and then talk quickly about CLL, where there is just an emerging cellular therapy in that space. So first off, let's talk about axi-cel. We heard from Dr. Weston about its activity in relapse refractory large cell lymphoma, moving up into the second line and now even into the first line in clinical trials. It's no stranger that axi-cel does also work in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. You can see here very good overall response rates at 94%, with the vast majority of patients at 79% achieving a metabolic CR. And I think if there's anything that we can learn from cellular therapy is that CR is king. If you can get your patients into a CR, that is where the durability comes. How you get them into CRs, I think, is one hand, CAR T-cell, but I think in other diseases we need to figure out other ways. You can see here that there still is a trend on the left side here of the PFS curve showing that patients are relapsing post-follicular lymphoma, but I think on the right side here is what they're relapsing with. So it appears to me, based upon these overall survival curves, that these patients are not relapsing with transformed follicular lymphoma, that they are likely relapsing with follicular lymphoma, and whether or not there is an immune reset or a reset of the disease, I think is something that we continue to explore in indolent diseases like follicular lymphoma and marginal zone lymphoma, which is included in the ZUMA-5 trial. With this, I think we have to keep in mind of what would they otherwise have gotten. And so this was the ZUMA-5 versus Scholar data set. And you can see here that CAR T-cell with axi-cel not only performed better, you can see on the left-hand curve, but there was a split in regards to overall survival. And so I think that in this situation where there are many products, the crowded space and the relapse refractory follicular lymphoma, it's not a matter of will CAR T-cell work, but when you should pull CAR T-cell out of the hat in order to use it in relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. But it's not the only CAR T-cell in this space, and you can see here tisocell and relapse follicular lymphoma based upon the ALARA trial, and you can see, again, 69% of the patients achieving a CR, two-thirds being progression-free at 67 months, and really trying to dig in deep to what these follicular lymphoma patients were. You could see POD24 patients still doing well, 60%, Maybe if you had more bulk of disease, and I think we see this across the landscape in CAR T cell, it needs a little bit of help in these bulkier or high tumor metabolic tumor volume patient populations. But even our double refractory patients, as we see in large cell lymphoma, our CAR T cells are agnostic to those what you've seen before type of processes, but perhaps not in regards to the volume of disease. You can see here that the CRs do matter, and that's where progression-free and duration of response lives when we see these blue curves, and we need to be doing better to those patients who we can either identify that we need to do more, even in the landscape of follicular lymphoma. You can see not only here with regards to another data set, looking at the ALARA versus the RECORD FL, kind of dovetailing very nicely on the ZUMA 5 versus the SCHOLAR 5 data set, recapitulating this data of it's not a matter of when you pull CAR T cell, but what other therapies they've received around it. And the newest kid on the block is Lysocell. And I call this out because this was a recent publication. I know it's not approved in the second line setting, but darn, these were some sick follicular lymphoma patients. Probably in the clinic, you're saying, I just haven't thrown enough darts into this individual to find their transformed follicular lymphoma. And how did those second line patients do? They did very well, as did the patients who had received third line and beyond follicular lymphoma, CR rates of 96% in the second line group and 94%. And here you go. Yes, this needs longer follow-up, but those curves look very impressive also. So putting it all together, axi-cel, T-cell, Lysocell, looking at CR rates just going across, I think very comparable in regards to getting to CRs, very impressive activity. I think we need to kind of watch the median PFS in this disease as the Lysocell data appears to continue to be very immature, but we will be watching these curves at major meetings like this one to see updated data. We still need to pay attention to toxicity, I think, in this population of indolent lymphomas. And really, in regards to, in my opinion, what I worry about the most is grade 3, 4 ICANS. I think that that is the quality of life limiting toxicity with cellular therapies. So now jumping over to mantle cell lymphoma in the ZUMA 2 trial with Bruxucel, you can see impressive 93% overall response rate. Again, two-thirds of the individuals getting into a CR. Again, CR rules in that, just like O'Doyle, from that standpoint, if you can get into a CR, those CRs can also be durable. Also, with regards to overall survival, I think this is the ZUMA 2 trial did show us that, again, getting into a CR may portend longer overall survival in a patient population that was heavily exposed to BTK inhibitors. And in that regard, we know how poorly our patients do with mantle cell lymphoma once they have become refractory to a BTKI, covalent BTKI. And now I'm going to jump to Lysocell from the Transcend NCL portion. As an author on this paper, I agree the manuscript was very hard to read. It was hard to kind of get out of this, so that's why I put the consort diagram in it. But nevertheless, the data is what it is, and I think it was done in a little bit different of an environment than some of the other mantle cell studies. You can see here the high-risk features of not only high Ki-67, but TP53 mutation, as well as blastoid morphology as being represented in this trial. And you can see here from a median PFS, it was 15.3 months, and median OS at 18 months. And why do I call that out? Because really people are keying in on this, looking at comparable CR rates, but really disparate, I would say, median PFS and median OS between Bruxucel and Lysocell. And really, I think we need to take longer than 1 to 2 minutes to dive into both of these trials before we start to compare them side by side. I call this a rotten tomato slide. Also in regards to toxicities, because not only has toxicity management evolved with Bruxucel, but it also, you know, with Lysocell, as we've learned, that mantle cell just may taste a little bit different to our patients getting CAR T-cell, or their CAR T-cells may taste a little bit different if they're getting it for mantle cell. And we see that truly in the ICANS grade 3 or higher at 31% and 9%, which is higher for Lysocell here too. from that standpoint. And in my last few moments here, I'm going to talk a little bit about a relapse refractory CLL in the Transcend CLL trial, where, again, if you can get these patients, which is very hard to get CLL into a CR, right? You can go into the single agent BTKs. They're mostly PRs. But if you can get a patient into a CR and in minimal residual disease, undetectable CR, those patients with CLL can do well regardless if they're BTK, BCL2 failures. And I think that's going to be the sweet spot for the for Lysocell in a CLL population, is truly picking that right patient who's seen both classes that can be bridged with some sort of therapy to a CAR T cell. And I predict that I think that the data in the real world will look better than the Transcend CLL data set, because patients will be treated earlier. Median lines of therapy on this trial was 5. And with that, I think that was my last slide. If it's not, then it was really just to talk about toxicity, where it actually looked really good in regards to not only a CRS. There was no grade 4 or 5 CRS events and no grade 5 events with regards to ICANS in the CLL population, which we tend to worry about leukemic disease and toxicities around CAR T cell. And with that, we'll jump to our faculty case presentations, and I get to stay at the podium here because I think, Dr. Brody, you get to talk to us about your follicular lymphoma patient.
Anything to get to see you standing up, Dr. Lunning.
I don't have a soapbox that I'm standing on.
You're almost as short as me.
I am.
51-year-old patient of mine with follicular lymphoma. She was treated with rituximab and bendamustine. She had a brief but complete remission for less than a couple of years, and then was treated with an innominate CD3 by CD20 bispecific antibody, actually on a clinical trial. I think I actually want to show you just after her relapse. So this was after her relapse from our bandage. She had this repeat biopsy, always worthwhile when doable, showing that those were B cells, CD79 positive, and they expressed the target of that bispecific antibody, CD20. She had, so you see that pretty large left adrenal mass there after that bispecific antibody melted away completely, a wonderful complete response there. Unfortunately, that complete response was rather brief, lasting less than a year. And when she relapsed now, this is a PET instead of a CT with a right adrenal mass, and those SUVs are quite high. We were sure, like Matthew was saying, we just didn't throw enough darts to find the transformation, but we biopsied this a couple times, and here was the result of that biopsy. This common but frustrating thing that was alluded to before, this problem of antigen escape, the target of the CD20 bispecific antibody disappeared. And this is frustratingly common, I would say, in follicular, maybe DLBCL, with bispecific antibodies. Seems like even more so than with CAR T cells. So now we've a little bit lost some components of our armamentarium, everything with CD20 targeting. So she was treated with a CD19 CAR T cell, leave it innominate. It was named. It was Axicel, and she had a beautiful response. All of that grapefruit melted away, and this has been ongoing now for this patient about a year. The little FDG avidity you see there, again, is just the renal collecting system. So a great response in it. What is a common situation and a scary one when you can't use any of your CD20 antibody-based therapies to treat the patients.
Thank you, Dr. Brody. These are eloquent slides, and I love your use of armamentarium there. But because you said, you know, we are limiting our armamentarium in follicular lymphoma, interesting second-line bispecific, you know, what data do we have about the efficacy of CAR T-cell after a bispecific?
Yeah, wow, not a lot. Some real-world case series, I guess is the best I could call them, with, you know, double-digit numbers of patients showing responses. They have some similar data in myeloma, but let's not, you know, conflate them, but, you know, at least common biology in some ways that we can see good efficacy. But the real question you're hinting is the CAR T impaired by the bispecific? We don't know the answer, and we would guess it also depends how long since the bispecific. Then again, you got to give them something. Right? So, you know, is bispecific maybe harmful to the future CAR T? Maybe a little bit, probably less so with time, but hopefully still less toxic than bendamustine, for example, if you're going to get something.
Yeah, this appears to be another situation where the real-world data is going to inform us that clinical trials aren't. Yeah. And Dr. Wesson, that's a great segue to, since we're not going to have a randomized trial of axi-cel versus lysocell versus tisocell in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, how are we choosing in follicular lymphoma, you know, what CAR T-cell you're going to use?
It's a huge problem for indolent lymphomas, for both follicular, for mantle cell, and for CLL, of how do we choose which therapy for which patient? If you have timelines that are measured in years or maybe even decades, it's a real problem to be able to know long-term outcomes. And I think that for a patient in the clinic who's got an aggressive version of follicular lymphoma, this patient that you showed that had the highest UVs, that's a patient that you are very worried about. You want to use the most effective therapy, but what you want to really do is give the most durable therapy. What's going to give them the best chance of long-term outcomes? I am enthusiastic about the use of cell-free DNA or ctDNA as a surrogate marker for outcomes for indolent lymphomas. Doing these real-world analyses where we have to follow patients for 3, 5, 10 years to see what the long-term outcomes are, that is hard to really get confidence early on of which treatment may be the best for a particular patient. I do think having an early surrogate readout of ctDNA would perhaps give us an idea of what's going to be more durable for that patient.
Yeah, that could be the third educational session on what cell-free or ctDNA is going to win out in the future. But we don't have time for that, folks. So we're going to actually move on to our next case, which will be from Dr. Weston about a mantle cell lymphoma patient he saw.
Yeah, so we are very fortunate at our center here in MD Anderson to have Dr. Michael Wong. So we see a lot of mantle cell patients, and a lot of them have very aggressive disease traveling from quite far and wide. So this is a patient in our clinic who's now 72 years old, but was previously diagnosed 6 years ago with TP53, a wild-type mantle cell lymphoma, treated initially outside in a community practice with bendamustine Rituxan for 6 cycles and achieved a complete response, which lasted for a number of years. 4 years later, the patient relapsed and was treated with a BTK inhibitor and achieved another complete response, which lasted about 1.5 years, and then had progression while on continuous therapy. The patient shows up at our clinic and is sick. They have bulky adenopathy. The LDH is quite high. The patient's losing weight. This is the patient you're worried about that potentially could die of their sort of indolent-ish lymphoma. Mantle cell sometimes presents in ways that looks a lot more like a slow-growing lymphoma. This is looking like a much more aggressive lymphoma. And so this patient has chosen to receive CAR T-cell therapy, receives Brexucel, and does have toxicities. As we saw in the Zuma study that was shown by Dr. Lunning, CAR T-cell toxicities are significant with mantle cell lymphoma patients, perhaps even more so than large B-cell lymphoma. So this patient had grade 2 CRS and grade 3 ICANS, which is the scary version of ICANS. This is often the go-to-the-ICU level of ICANS. But this patient recovered quickly. About a third of patients in the study had grade 3 ICANS. This patient, within 5 days, had resolved high-dose steroids with the side effects that go into that. But the patient achieved a complete response and is now in long-term follow-up after having this very aggressive presentation through BTK inhibitor therapy, making you quite nervous. So clearly a remarkable response.
So thank you for giving a shout out to the ultimate warrior, Dr. Michael Wong for mantle cell lymphoma. I know, and there's a reason why I say that, because I know he's brought a lot of upfront BTK to mantle cell lymphoma. So does that mean if you're BTK exposed, BTK refractory, that the next step in first relapse is CAR T?
I don't think all mantle cell relapses are created equal. And back to the discussion I just shared with that patient who looked sick, that patient looks to me like they're at risk of dying of their disease. There are some patients who receive one of Dr. Wong's window studies where you get a BTK inhibitor up front, and then they may progress afterwards, but it may not have that sort of fulminant explosion of disease. I think those patients may benefit from other options as well. But if we do move therapies up front, that may change the natural history of our diseases, and perhaps we need to adjust where we use CAR T-cell therapy.
Very good. And I don't want to forget about CLL, because I think it is a discussion about when to take those patients to CAR T-cell. And Dr. Brody, I think that you and I probably both have a little bit different skewed CLL practice, because I see a lot of 30, 40-year-olds, and I try to talk to them about, like, I need to get you 40 years for your CLL/SLL. How are you having that conversation now that CAR T-cell? When is the right time for CAR T-cell in that population? Understanding it's probably 5% of the disease, but it's probably going to be a vast majority of the people who see this.
Yeah, we get some young patients with CLL, and we tell them it's a slow-growing disease, but right, still, 60 years would be a slow-growing disease, and then it would get you at 59. We want to get them up to age 100. You know, if we had... So first of all, we call these indolent diseases incurable. That's very silly. The disease is not incurable. That's us. We haven't got the cure yet. The disease is totally curable. Hodgkin's was incurable in 1945. Now it's quite curable. So if we had a hint of a plateau on some of these curves, I would happily move CAR-T as to be a standard third-line therapy. But we're getting more and better therapies, you know, pirtobrutinib, reversible BTK inhibitors that are, I think, honestly, for most of these patients, still, if they have the option, they're 40-year-olds, they're working full-time, of something that's not going to take them away from work, I don't think we're going to get these things. You said median lines of therapy was 5 in this study. Yeah, maybe before 5 would be good, but it's probably still 4.
Right.
You know, hard to get them ahead of BTK, BTK, or BCL2 today. So I think it should be standard fourth-line therapy, but not third yet.
Not yet. All right. And with that, I'm going to invite Dr. Brody to be our anchor for the afternoon here session. Josh, the podium is yours now. Mine later.
You made an Ultimate Warrior reference. I think that was a World Wrestling Federation comment.
That was,
but
yes.
I don't know if this is the audience for WWF. WWE now, I suppose. I came from New York today, so it's great to be in Texas, where at least 30% of people enjoy a WWF joke. Up in New York, it's a lot lower. Okay, I have an advancer. There we go. Thank you. We heard about some of the wonderful standard of care practices with CAR T-cells, some of the new advances, some of the future being alluded to. Because I'm so charmingly put it on me to show the bad side, these therapies are not benign. It was already mentioned and some of the numbers were alluded to, but I'm going to try to be more specific on a few of these toxicities and issues of tolerability. Maybe most important data point on this slide is what's in yellow. There's my email address. You guys can email me questions because I talk real fast, and sometimes when I'm in the Midwest, people don't know what I'm saying because I got a little bit of an accent, so sorry about that. Okay, we're going to talk about not the toxicity first, but I feel like people are in the audience that are experts, this is silly for them. But I always have 40% of people in the audience say, you know what, Josh, I like that slide where you explained what CAR was, because I've been using the word CAR-T for a decade now. My patients say, what does that mean? I was like, oh, it's like an automobile. So CAR is a very simple thing. It is a chimera of two antigen receptors. What antigen receptors? The only two antigen receptors that humans have, a B-cell receptor and a T-cell receptor. So the targeting is done with a B-cell receptor. We just call that an antibody. And the T-cell receptor is not literally a T-cell receptor. It's the signaling moieties, the CD3 and second signal components of a T-cell receptor, not the TCR molecule itself. So you take those two antigen receptors, you chimerize them, as they used to do back in Greek mythology in the old days, and now you have a chimeric antigen receptor. The word actually makes sense. We are not lawyers. We are trying to make English-speaking words that make sense. Or we're trying. Not the dermatologists. They don't even try. So a CAR T-cell is a T-cell that you shoved a CAR a genetic construct into. CAR T-cell. Makes sense once you break it down. Okay. We are going to talk not first about the toxicities of the therapy, but even prior toxicities going into the therapy. And as we mentioned very briefly before, what is the right therapy to get before CAR T-cell therapy? And the answer is we don't know. Even with these awesome phase 3 randomized trials showing overall survival benefits, we still don't do regular clinical practice as per the trials. ZUMA-7, no bridging therapy. Standard clinical practice for almost every patient, bridging therapy. We quickly deviate, even though we want to stick to the recipe as best we can. And yet, we give bridging therapy. We do not have any data about what's the right bridging therapy. Here's a little bit of data about maybe what is the wrong bridging therapy. And it's a bit of, you know, tricky data, because this is retrospective data, a beautiful paper from Dr. Jacobini in JCO a couple of years ago now, showing that the patients that got bendamustine prior to CAR T therapy had worse overall outcomes. So that could be because the bendamustine messed up the CAR T cell, or it could be a big confounder. Just if they got benda, they were in a worse situation for some reason, and so that's why they did worse. And they tried in this excellent study to adjust for those confounders, but it is very hard to adjust perfectly for confounders that you don't know about. I don't like to quote Donald Rumsfeld. In fact, I avoid it, but there's unknown unknowns, and you can't adjust for them. So maybe is bendamustine okay? You know what? Even if this paper was wrong, maybe it wouldn't matter because, oh, sorry, and that was the punchline data, that the recent benda patients that had benda within 9 months of going to the CAR T cells, had much worse progression-free survival and significantly worse overall survival. So even if that data were confounded, I don't think it is. I think it's reasonable data. Still, wait, maybe we can forget data and just use a little bit of common sense. We do know, these are not opinions, these are facts, that bendamustine is tough on lymphocytes, tough on blood cells overall, tough on platelets, tough on everything, but especially tough on lymphocytes and especially tough on certain T-cell subsets. And you can see the data there, and maybe in the right figure in the last column, you see it can take almost a year for T-cell subsets to get back up to where they were. Maybe not surprising that if you get pheresed to make CAR T-cells prior to that, you're going to have possibly a crappier product. Can I use the word crappier here?
I think crappy's okay.
Okay, just checking. And we do know, so that this is finishing out the syllogism, the chain law, that if Benda gives you bad T-cells, and we do know that bad T-cells correlate, we wouldn't quite say cause, but correlate with bad CAR T products. So even if that initial Benda study was confounded because it's difficult to perfectly adjust, still, it just makes sense to avoid, you know, highly lymphotoxic agents within months. And also, when you give chemo, you don't know when their CAR T is going to be needed, when they will relapse. So it should make us just think about, I don't like the way this patient's course is going. I may avoid Benda if I have some other options for him. Matt was grilling me on, do you give the patients bispecifics? We don't know, but we think we do know what not to give. A lot of buttons here. So the toxicity of CAR T-cells are many, Dr. Weston alluded to many of them already. I won't belabor the points. We have these different constructs and different results with each of them. We have a contribution of different factors, things about the patient, things about the CAR T-cell product, and probably some vague inflammatory factors, things that are in the host that we don't totally appreciate, whether they came from the CAR T-cell or from the patient. The point is it's a multi-parametric decision to decide what's the likelihood this patient's going to get bad CRS or bad ICONS. And really the answer is you ask an expert. I'm pointing at Jason and not Matthew, no offense. So just to compare products, apples and oranges, not of course head-to-head trials, just focusing on the high grade, greater than grade 3 CRS and ICONS, you see that the numbers have been higher with AxiCell in, again, non-head-to-head studies, but we have to acknowledge it. You saw me say nice things about AxiCell, but give that older patient lysocell. So it is a very individualized decision with those many factors going into it, and ultimately you want the lick thumb test from an expert. And Matthew is also an expert. Sorry, I was rough.
It's okay.
These numbers give you a hint that you have to monitor and manage patients in according with their likelihood of getting these side effects. We have colleagues giving lysocell in the outpatient setting. My institution doesn't do it yet. It's a tough call. But if you had a 1% grade 3 CRS risk, you could see outpatient lysocell. If you had a 6% risk, it's a tougher decision to make. It's an institutional decision. But these numbers determine how we have to monitor and manage patients. Another toxicity that we talk a little bit less about, probably not in and of itself is terrible, but does, especially, I'm going to say, in the COVID era, Texas believes in COVID, right? Okay. So in the era when we want to vaccinate patients for flu, RSV, and possibly COVID, hypogammaglobulinemia is a problem. You see, it's not as bad a problem. The top half of the page there is B-cell therapy, CD19 CAR-T, as opposed to the BCMA CAR-T that even have greater plunges and earlier and greater depths of hypogammaglobulinemia. I won't say much more about this other than it absolutely requires monitoring even long after the patient is discharged from the hospital and possibly from the CAR-T center, and probably earlier, this is a belief, not a fact, earlier initiation of replacement therapy. Cytopenia is similarly can be extremely heterogeneous. When I first heard about this CAR hematotox score, I thought, it's all common sense. Of course, the people with worse platelets have worse platelets later. But actually, as I've appreciated it more, this is a pretty powerful tool. You can go online, go to Google, and ask for CAR hematotox. If you don't know how to find Google, it's HTTP. No, I'm not going to. And you can see this patient is very likely to have prolonged cytopenias or less likely. You see, everyone has some, but some of them are quite brief, and some of them can be, in fact, quite long-lasting, with, you can imagine, implications for their risk of infections. I'm just going to quickly, for the sake of time, allude to the fact that infections are a very serious, and I would say underemphasized, toxicity of CAR T cells. People say CAR T, they hear CRS ICONS, and that's what they think. No, non-relapse mortalities are primarily due to infections. In fact, I'm just going to skip to a bit of this detailed data just to show the emphasis of that. So there's a beautiful retrospective review in Nature Medicine earlier this year showing that the majority of non-relapse mortality in these CAR-T patients is because of infections. Numbers can range from 5 to 10% depending on disease type and some other metrics. But that is a lot of patients, and they do not happen by day 30 or by day 90. So this is super important for the primary oncologist, the community oncologist that might be inheriting this patient back from the CAR-T center if that's the business model. This requires close observation, diligence to any patient complaints, you know, the way we take a neutropenic patient seriously. And I'm just going to have one more comment here about the actionability of it. If we give a lower threshold for use of prophylactic antibodies, it would probably benefit patients. And I won't say that. I'll just give it as an editorial. I'm going to mention only one word that we've heard a lot about. Maybe CAR T cells can cause T cell lymphoma afterwards. I have the concept here that in theory, the CAR gene, instead of landing in a benign spot in the genome, could land in the middle of a P53 gene, a tumor suppressor, break the gene, and cause increased risk for subsequent cancers. The data really has been in a couple of beautiful studies. This one and I have to mention that even before we had CAR T cells, patients with B-cell lymphomas did have a much higher risk of T-cell lymphomas later on. So maybe we shouldn't blame CAR T-cell for every patient that had a T-cell lymphoma after a B-cell lymphoma. This was happening in the 90s and 2000s and 2010s before CAR T-cell were a problem. And the risk was sometimes 4 to 10-fold higher than the average patient. Just a couple of quick series of two centers, both the center at UPenn and the center at Stanford, showing anecdotes that they had examples of patients with T-cell lymphomas after CAR-T that were not causally related. We do have at least a couple of examples in the world of causally related T-cell lymphomas after CAR-T, but a number of anecdotes and case series showing that we can have plenty of T-cell lymphomas even that were not caused by the insertion of the CAR. And I think I'm going to end there for the sake of time. I'll ignore all this sciencey stuff after that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brody. I thought I was going to have to give you the virtual hook.
I was worried about that specifically.
But you made my job easier by just stopping yourself. I know you're a enthusiast for education. And so now we're going to jump in to our next faculty case presentations. And Dr. Weston, lead us off.
Yes, thank you. So this is a lot of words, but basically it's to talk about toxicities right after Dr. Brody went through them. So this patient, a large B-cell lymphoma, had R-CHOP and the disease came back, had aggressive disease and received a bridging therapy followed by axi-cel. Grade 1 CRS develops within a day and then evolves to grade 2 on day 3. The patient's treated with a standard algorithm, including tocilizumab, and then followed by dexamethasone. The fever comes down, blood pressure recovers, but then the fever comes back. Unfortunately, these therapies don't always quash the side effects permanently, but sometimes temporarily suppress. On day 5, the patient is less verbal and appears confused. The ICE score, which is a toxicity grading score to assess the patient's cognition, drops from 10 out of 10, a perfect score, down to 3 out of 10 in the afternoon and 0 out of 10 in the evening. This patient is crashing neurologically and is transferred to the intensive care unit. No seizures noted, no imaging findings, and the patient starts on high-dose steroids, very high-dose steroids, which are then continued for a few days and then beginning to taper after the patient has a recovery. It can be a scary couple of days, not so much for the patients because they're often not aware of what's happening, but for their family, for the caregivers, and for the medical team, having a patient that effectively becomes obtunded after having a fever the day before can be a shocking experience. But generally speaking, these are reversible side effects if managed aggressively early on. This patient then was discharged to rehab on day 13. So recovery occurs even though the patient can certainly look like they're in big trouble when this is happening.
Yeah, I've certainly to change my practice to have a discussion about some patients may need to go to rehab, especially if they're getting ICANS high grade, and just leaning into that before. So do you think that there's a relationship between the CAR T cell therapy toxicity and treatment benefit? So, you know, I have this, like, if nothing's happening, it's still working. But if it's happening, really happening, Does that mean that they're automatically going to be in a CR at day 100?
Unfortunately, no. So it doesn't always correlate. Having bad toxicity doesn't mean you've got a great response. We've had examples of patients with no CRS who go on to get a response, and the opposite can be true of having terrible CRS or ICANS and unfortunately not achieving a durable response. The immune system is not this monolithic either on or off type thing, and so better understanding of why those patients get toxicity is important. It's not just part of the CAR T-cell journey that has to happen in order to get a CR. It's a toxicity that we'd love to avoid.
100% agree. And Dr. Brody, so you have a grade 3 ICANS patient related to the CAR T-cell. What's the typical course of recovery for them? You pointed out cytopenias. I always call it the double dip.
I think Jason's patient, you're asking about the typical course. I think Jason's was the typical course in terms of their ICANS recovery, but it's still, as he said, super scary while you're crossing your fingers that they're going to obey the typical course, that they're going to read the textbook that Jason wrote. Most of them do. After ICANS recovery, still they have all of these. And again, I think maybe we overemphasize the acute toxicities of CAR T-cell, because as we see now from these retrospective analyses, people are not, thank God, dying from ICANS, the vast majority, or from a CRS, the vast majority. Non-relapse mortalities, if anything, infection-related more than anything else. There's also some secondary malignancies. Even though we talk about the T-cell lymphoma, all other secondary malignancies, solid cancers, whether they're really increased risk or it's just that 70-year-olds have that risk. The course afterwards should be close to monitoring either at the CAR T center or a very kind of thorough handoff back to the community oncologist.
Yeah, I think we're realizing also that the other vitamin R is remdesivir in the COVID environment post-CAR T-cell too. So I'm going to give an example of a case that I have, who's a 44-year-old who has incredibly bad large cell lymphoma. You can see she presented with a liver lesion that was thought to be HCC, biopsied, and guess what? Cell of origin, you know, matters, and it was large cell lymphoma, a double hit. Got dose-adjusted EPOCH-R and just was with resolution, but kind of fitting along, this would have been a great Zuma 23 candidate, because after six cycles, they were progressing and had large cell lymphoma. So a really bad large cell lymphoma, you almost know when you start them in the hospital that isn't by definition, I think, a bad large cell lymphoma. So she gets tried to get to CAR T-cell, and we got there. You know, I think 50% of the battle is getting to CAR T-cell these days. She gets axi-cel and does have grade 2 CRS and grade 3 ICANS. And I think your institution, Dr. Weston, kind of looked at the total dex equivalents to get there. And this was over 30 days. She had 300 milligrams of dex equivalents. And I know that that's not good when you think about not only for early fungal infections, and we actually changed to mold prophylaxis when we get into this situation, because we do recognize that concern, but she has a left lower lobe consolidation at day 30. I guess fortunately it wasn't mucor, it was Pseudomonas, and she was able to make it through that, and was started on monthly IVIG. You know, she said multiple viral infections, but nothing that's high grade, and she finally had resolution of her cytopenias. Fortunately, at day 100 and at 6 months, she maintained a metabolic CR and was able to get back to work 6 months after her CAR T cell. So a long sledge, you know, sludge, a long road.
Yeah, let's go with road.
To recovery. So, you know, Dr. Weston, kind of walk us through your antimicrobial prophylaxis for patients receiving CAR T.
Yeah, I think the data that Dr. Brody showed about the non-relapse mortality, that infection is the true driver of late deaths after CAR T cell, is something that's not as well known as it should be. And antimicrobial prophylaxis doesn't guarantee that won't happen, but it does reduce the risk. So certainly pneumocystis prophylaxis is part of our algorithm. There's different ways to do that. Bactrim is one, but there are other ways to do that. But that should be something that we, at our center, we continue for at least a year, evaluating if the CD4 count recovery has happened at the end of that year, and perhaps even continuing it beyond that. Zoster is one that we continue for a year. Even though patients aren't typically at risk of dying of zoster, it can be quite unpleasant and can be a quality of life issue. And that is mainly our antibiotic prophylaxis as a durable therapy. As Dr. Brody mentioned, sometimes we look at fungal or mold prophylaxis if a patient had a significant ICANS, high-dose steroids, cytopenias that are durable afterwards. So I think infectious prophylaxis is absolutely critical after CAR T-cell therapy to try and avoid those late risks of death.
So some patients on fungal prophylaxis, but not everyone.
Not everyone. We customize it based on kind of what was their CAR T-cell experience. And if they didn't have too bad of a ride, probably don't need it. But if they have a significant toxicity or high-dose steroids or both, probably benefit from it.
Makes a lot of sense.
And I'm actually scared to do this, but Dr. Brody, I'm going to give you the last question of the session to try and end us on time. Vaccinations after CAR T-cell, yes or no?
Yes, they don't work as well, but yes.
Okay. And with that, I didn't think we could do it. I thought Dr. Weston could keep us on time, but I was almost certain that Dr. Brody and myself were going to get us way behind, and we didn't do it today, folks. So thank you again for joining us. I love not seeing computers or you know, and the only thing that was being out there with your phone was taking pictures of these great colleagues of mine up here on stage. And so I appreciate your attention and all of the questions that you sent through. I appreciate you all, and have a great SoHo.